Golf Today.
Some heads will be suffering on Long Island today, but that I'll tell you is worth it. The European team celebrating a 15-13 victory over the United States at Bethpage Black. The 45th Ryder Cup match has produced a lot more Sunday drama than expected. The first away win in the Cup in 13 years. Welcome into Golf Today. I am Eamon Lynch alongside George Savarikas. And George, every time we have a Ryder Cup, every 2 years, sometimes the trophy heads home in a different direction. Sometimes the fans behave, sometimes they don't. The one thing that we can count on is the drama always seems to deliver.
And that's what we were worried about after the first couple days. It was such a blowout and such a large number that the U.S. had to try and overcome. Was Sunday going to be meaningful to any degree? Was there going to be any reason to tune in the second half of Sunday singles? We hadn't had a close Ryder Cup in more than a decade. So at least if you're just a fan of the Ryder Cup, going in, you wanted to see one that came down to the final three or four matches on Sunday that was only decided by a couple points, which from 87 to 99, every Ryder Cup was decided by 2 points or less. We had gotten in this recent run where there were all these blowouts, which for two-thirds of it, it was a massive blowout. But the Ryder Cup, it's such a fun spectacle because we see a different side of guys being in a team sport in an individual game. And one where there's full buy-in for both the European side and seemingly the American side of representing something greater than themselves. And that's what makes it so special every couple years. But now it's turned very lopsided. I mean, Europe's won two in a row, nine of the last 12. The Americans clearly have some issues to unpack, which is something that we're going to get to throughout the show for both sides.
And those were the kind of days where it seemed as though the Europeans were just going to coast to the finish line. Those are the days that give guys like me gray hair, George. You wouldn't know anything about that yet. It'll come to you later in life, though.
Slowly getting there. Slowly getting there, Eamon. And, it's going to be fun to just do. I mean, we got Brandel Chamblee coming up, Paul McGinley, Golf Digest writers joining us as well. So we're going to get a lot of different perspectives on why has Europe been able to continue going on this run. And what has been the U.S. issue recently when you have these star players who are just unable to seemingly deliver when it comes to team competition? And here's how the final Sunday singles shook out. And I guess the silver lining, Eamon, the U.S. ties the Sunday singles record with 8.5 points, but it was such a futile effort at the end to make the final margin closer than it appeared.
Yeah, the first team ever to win 8.5 of the singles points and not actually win the Ryder Cup. And here are Europe's wins on United States soil.
It's dating back to 1987, and that's when the Ryder Cup really started to become the Ryder Cup. The Europeans had won in 85, then they won on U.S. soil in 87. They retained it in 89, so they had three consecutive times they had won the Ryder Cup. And since 1985, they have won or retained 14 of 20 Ryder Cups. 5 times they've won on foreign soil. In that time, the U.S. has only done it once. Afterwards, the winning captain, Luke Donald, with Keira K. Dixon.
All right, Luke, you're covered in champagne. The Ryder Cup is covered in champagne, but that means good things have happened. You are a two-time winning Ryder Cup captain, winning away here at Bethpage, no less. I know you're still processing everything, but what are the emotions right now?
Yeah, so happy for the guys. This has been a 3.5-year project, really. You know, I've tried to dedicate myself to it, and I'm just so happy that it's worked out more for my team. They're just incredible, incredible people, incredible team. They really made my job quite easy, to be honest, the way they played. Big congratulations to the U.S. and how they fought today. I mean, it was, my heart was in my throat all day. And at one point, you know, I had some doubts, and that was tough. But all credit to Keegan and his team for fighting so hard.
When you came over, you said, oh my goodness, I'm still stressed. What was the most stressful part of today?
Ryder Cups are stressful. I don't know why. It just means so much to these guys. You know, we put so much time into it, so much effort. And to obviously, you know, get the lead we had was incredible. But again, the U.S. pushed us all the way. And it's just stressful. We, both teams, we want it so badly. We want it. And I'm glad we were able to get over the line.
What was it like watching Shane have that special moment with the clinching putt?
Yeah, I didn't know. Again, so difficult as a captain to know where to go, who was going to do it. Shane was one down, going down the last. I was with one of the other groups. I was walking down 17 with Rosie, and I was watching it on the screen, and that putt went in, and it's just the relief, the joy. I didn't know really what to feel. You know, I really didn't. It's incredible what this little gold trophy means.
I know you're still celebrating all of this, but I have to say, I saw your daughters chanting two more years on the 18th green. Is it possible that we see potentially even four more years? Is it possible that we see you continue your Ryder Cup captaincy?
I'm not gonna really answer that question right now. I really just want to enjoy tonight with my team.
Enjoy, well deserved. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And here's why that Sunday was so stressful for Luke Donald. These are the most single points earned by a team in a Ryder Cup since 1979. Five times teams have won 8.5 points, but yesterday was the only time that the team who did that didn't actually win the Ryder Cup. The losing captain, Keegan Bradley, caught up with Todd Lewis after the ceremony.
Keegan, you said your team, you felt like when they came to the golf course today that they had great belief that they could get this done. As you watch them just about do that, tell me the emotions going through your head and your heart.
Well, it was crazy because, you know, we said when the boys went to bed last night when they were leaving, they really felt like they could win. I thought they were crazy. I mean, I didn't. I thought they could too. But they believed it. I mean, sometimes you can tell if they're not, you know, they say it but don't believe it. And I can tell when they left and when they left the course today, like they thought they could do this. And they came just close. It was a great try.
How challenging was it to hear that Victor Hovland was injured and that would, you know, statistically diminish your chances?
Yeah, I mean, it was 25% of the points they needed to win. And nothing against, you know, Victor. I'm sure he's, you know, he's hurt and everything, but that rule has to change, obviously. I think it's obvious now. But they, you know, everything that they did was by the book, and, you know, I don't have anything against them for that.
Why do you think it has to change?
Well, we're playing this amazing, you know, if a person gets hurt on the football field, you don't give them 7 points if Tom Brady gets hurt. But, I mean, listen, this is part of what the Ryder Cup is. It's part of what makes it unique. It's got different rules, and it's a bummer that had to happen. I'm sure Victor is really bummed out, too.
It's been a fascinating journey since you were announced as captain. How would you describe the ride that you had been on as captain?
It was crazy. You know, it was a shock to me, a shock to everybody. But, you know, I learned a lot about myself and the team, these guys. They turned me into a different person. I lived a life of sort of loneliness on tour. Now, and they forced me to sit down and talk to people, and it's so much better. And they taught me that, and I'm grateful for that.
Finally, how would you describe the love that you have for everyone in your U.S. team room?
I'm just so thankful for this opportunity. I'm so thankful for them. I'm so thankful that I got to just experience this. This is something I never thought I was ever going to get to do. Being Ryder Cup captain is about one of the hardest things to be ever, you know, in any profession. And I really had a blast doing it, and I'll have a lot of great memories from it.
Well done, Keegan.
Thank you.
Todd, touching all the bases with U.S. Captain Keegan Bradley, anything that stood out to you from that interview with Todd as we're unpacking what happened on not just the U.S. side, but the Ryder Cup in totality?
I think if you compare those two interviews side by side, Luke Donald and Keegan Bradley, it kind of lays bare what we've seen over the last couple of years. And you could even argue beyond that in terms of Ryder Cups. And it comes down to this idea of playing with a purpose, which isn't always easy to define. You kind of know it when you see it. And in the Europeans, they do have a very clearly defined purpose, and it's playing for their tour. It's a business thing for them in a way, because the European Tour is financially underpinned by the success of the Ryder Cup. It means a lot to those guys. It's not that they're playing under this amorphous European flag. I don't think there is a nationality thing to the European.
Not
thing.
At all.
I think there's an element of it, but I do think it's that they're motivating. You keep hearing Luke Donald talk about the gel that binds them together is the players who went before, who built up the tour, who built up the European team. Whereas on the US side, I do think it's more clear cut. It's patriotism that is the gel. It's a lot easier to do that when you're talking about one country. But too much of that, I think, gets cloaked in tough talk and theatrics, performative theatrics, in a way that the Europeans always seem more focused on the player comfort. We heard Luke Donald, he changed the bed linens in the shampoo in the hotel because he thought the players would be uncomfortable. That's an attention to detail. Whereas you look at the European or the US side, and I think they're more conscious of what's the consumer reaction, what's the outward facing messaging. And I think the Europeans tend to put less effort into that, more effort into the comfort and focus on their team. And the US seems to be much more focused on what is the outward message of the team. And I just think it puts more pressure on them. We've seen that the whole way along. I mean, the narrative for the last year and a half is whether it was all going to be about the captain. It was all about Keegan Bradley. Is he going to be on the team? Is he the Netflix captain? That kind of scenario. It was never really focused on the inward sort of mechanisms of what's the process of getting a good, successful team.
Well, and I think the Europeans, and everyone knew once Shane put it to 6 feet and Russell Henley missed the putt, that it seemed like it was the perfect setup for Shane to have his signature European Ryder Cup moment.
Seen that movie before, haven't
we? We've seen it play out time after time. And Europe does such a good job of having connectivity from captain to captain. And there have been blips for sure, but it seems like overall they have a playbook and a structure that has been passed down from captaincy to captaincy. And there isn't a huge amount of deviation or variation. And Paul McGinley has been a part of seven, either as a strategic advisor, captain in 2014, played on Ryder Cup teams. You don't hear the same with the U.S. side. Paul Azinger is a captain in 2008. Everyone says his pod system completely re-energized and re-engineered the U.S. team. He's never captain again. And you never heard his voice being one of the loudest to amplify, at least within U.S. team rooms after that. Steve Stricker in 2021. They looked amazing at Whistling Straits. Steve's probably still playing some of the PGA Tour champions. I didn't know that he wanted to have another captaincy after that. But you don't hear him publicly touted as, hey, he's a strategic advisor. Steve Stricker says X, Y, Z. He, Paul Azinger, other guys are part of the U.S. team that, regardless of who the captain is, we know the playbook. Keegan said he's learning on the fly. That should never be the case. Nor should a captain ever receive a call and be completely surprised that they're in the running and have never been a vice captain. Yeah. That would only happen on the U.S. side. That would never happen on the European side. The U.S. has this crazy pendulum swing every 2 to 4 years where we have a boys' club. All right, we're breaking up the boys' club. Okay, we lost. We're doing this. We won. We're great. But still, we're going to have a new captain 2 years after that. There's no cohesion or continuity, and you can see in the results. That's the only way to be able to explain how, on paper, the U.S. consistently has the stronger side, yet they consistently underperform in the Ryder Cup. That's the only way that you could say that makes sense.
And I think a lot of that goes back to the ownership model, the fact that the European Tour basically owns the European side of it. So these guys have that continuity, the investment, the purpose. On the other side, what we hear is a lot of different rationales every time there's an American defeat. You know, it's those guys just putted better than we did, or our top guys didn't play, or maybe the course didn't suit us, or maybe the captain made a couple of mistakes. There is one continuous thread through all of that, which is the PGA of America being in the middle of it. And these guys are not interested in the result of the Ryder Cup. They are interested in cashing a check and deferring to the players on all the responsibility of it, in terms of making the decisions behind it, in terms of the continuity of a backroom team or a statistical analysis team. They're not interested in that. That was the purpose of the task force after the 2014 debacle, was to defer all of the controversial decisions that might blow back on them to the players. And they just keep the revenue from it. And they're quite happy with that situation. But it doesn't work if you're looking for results, because to the point of Keegan Bradley's appointment as captain, he never even knew that he was in a discussion for that until he was called and offered the job. Now you're going to hear this groundswell will come up. Well, we need Tiger at Adair Manor in 2 years. He's got the stature. They've had plenty of captains with stature. Give us one with a plan. Where's the process here? Forget all the performative theatrics that America is really good at. Who actually has a plan and a process? Because Keegan was never interviewed for the job. And during the course of the week at Bethpage, when he had opportunities to articulate what the plan was or what the vision was, he didn't actually seem to be able to do that. Now, whether he may have had it, he just wasn't able to articulate it. But at no point does the PGA of America involve itself in what is a process here to a result that they want to see.
Well, I think the PGA of America put the U.S. team at a competitive disadvantage based on how the search for a captain played out. You then pluck a guy who arguably should have been picked in 2023 to be a playing captain, which is something that Team Europe would never do. Rory said, I would never be a playing captain. It's impossible to pull off. So you remove a guy who is arguably on the precipice of a top 12 American and could have easily been there in 2025. So you're already behind the eight ball just from having your best potential 12 players. Secondarily, he had never been a vice captain. He hadn't been in a team room at a Ryder Cup since 2014. He'd been in the President's Cup in 2024. But there was no structure to then prop him up. And with the PGA of America, you look at the potential captains they could have had or guys that they had skipped, et cetera. And part of it was they were waiting on Tiger to make a decision, yeah, reportedly. And Tiger, either through physical health or just where he was at, wasn't ready to be a captain in 2025. So they were completely scrambling. There was no backup plan. There should have been a plan in place prior to the search in 2025 to say, here's our shortlist, Tiger can't go, here's who will do it, instead of, hey, we're just going to surprise Keegan completely out of left field and make him be the captain. And then also during Keegan's captaincies, there are little small micro mistakes that the U.S. seems to make, especially when it comes to data analytics, that we don't hear the European side make. And you're going to double-click on Harris English, Colin Morikawa being run out a second time together, Russell Henley teeing off on odds hole out of the gates, and European side immediately saying this is likely going to be a point for us just because of these small that seem almost inconsequential mistakes at the time, but they're magnified because when they're made repeatedly, that can be the outcome in a Ryder Cup, and those 2 points could have been what swung.
Well, another mistake that the PGA of America has been making for 12 years is the marketing of this event as well. They kept talking about how this is going to be the biggest, the craziest, the loudest, the rowdiest, and that's what they get. They actually managed to green light the behaviour that we saw over the weekend. You know, they hire an MC to lead vulgar chants about Rory McIlroy, and which is, you know,
yeah, that was a disaster.
Laughable. But even the security laps when the security was required, it wasn't there. And this ought to be, in my mind, the last professional event ever played at Bethpage, because it's a recurring theme. And everyone likes to say, oh, it's a few bad apples. It's not a few bad apples at Bethpage. It's a vocal minority who are incapable of anything other than despicable behaviour at a golf tournament. We've seen it at the PGA Championship. We've seen it at two US Opens, although the rain dampened them a little in 09. And then what we saw at the weekend was laughable. But this is on the PGA of America. They marketed this event in that manner for 12 years after announcing it. And they don't get to hold their hands up and go, oh, we weren't expecting this.
Yeah, I do think the fans, anyone with any common sense coming into it thought the fans were going to be a factor and potentially problematic. And New York fans have that reputation. Yeah. And you just, from a sports standpoint, if we're talking football, baseball, whatever, New York fans, throw in Philly fans, those are usually the two on the East Coast where you're thinking, okay, they can go from rowdy to downright mean-spirited, where you're on a cusp, potentially crosses a line. So it shouldn't be a surprise. If you look at previous Ryder Cups, I don't think the fans necessarily got to that point. I do think the onus is on the PGA of America. Like, this is never an issue at the Masters or other certain events where they have fostered expectations coming into it. It's such a delicate balance of, okay, if you want fans to be rowdy, how do you make sure it doesn't cross the line past a respectful manner? And that's something that they need to clearly articulate so people have the proper mindset coming in.
Plus, an electric kettle prod wouldn't hurt as well, George. Well, after this break, we're going to have a round table with two guys who are at Bethpage. Rex Hoggard, Brendan Horath, coming right up. Time now for another round table. Golf Today. We welcome in Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard, Brendan Porath, who's co-host of the Shotgun Start podcast. And since both of you guys are Americans, you had no reason to be out celebrating late last night. Brendan, I want to start with you. What will the post-mortem declare here was more important? Was it the positives of Luke Donald's leadership or the negatives of Keegan Bradley's?
Ooh, that's a tough call, Eamon. I am impartial. I am American, but I'm an impartial journalist. I think we tend to often go toward the recriminations, towards the examination of the losing side. What could they have done better? Where did they lose at the margins? How did you lose at home? I think given the recent trend of dominant home wins, not just, you know, marginal home wins, but dominant home wins to the point where it has the Ryder Cup lost a bit of its luster, I do think the examination will go more towards the home side. We understand Luke Donald is an all-time, maybe the greatest captain of all times on the European side. But for me, it comes down to course setup, lineup choices, maybe some sort of a further clarification on how the American side uses data, if they have the proper data, if it's presented in the right golf way and golf intelligence way for execution on the golf course. But for me, it comes down to course setup, their top players being beaten badly through the first four sessions and failing to continue that trend of not just winning at home, but winning by a significant margin. I do think the greater scrutiny comes down on Keegan Bradley. In addition to all the praise for Luke Donald, I think it balances more towards what went wrong for the Americans.
Yeah, Scottie Scheffler going 1-4 was certainly a shock coming into the 45th Ryder Cup. Rex, how do you diagnose what happened?
Well, I would go a little bit the other way, simply because that European team may go down as the greatest in history. And I'm not basing it just on what we've seen this week. I'm not being a prisoner of the moment. I think you can take what we saw at Bethpage, at least through the first team 2 days of team play, as well as what we saw in Rome. And there was 11 of 12 that pulled over from Rome. This is pretty much the exact same team. And then you factor in who could be maybe the greatest captain of all time, and Luke Donald for either the American side or the European side. All of the little things that he does, it's fascinating to me to hear the nuance that he puts into the job, all the way down to shampoo and making sure those players have the right pillows. I love the conversation that you two were just having about maybe all of the things that Keegan Bradley did wrong, and we will have 2 years essentially to talk about and dissect that. But I think right now you celebrate this European team for what was a brilliant performance.
Rex, picking up on that, though, are there institutional failures in how America goes about choosing its team that fall at the door of the PGA of America here? Because you do get all of the sense of Luke Donald's attention to detail that there is actually a process by that team that extends all the way from inside the ropes all the way back to the shampoo in the hotel, whereas you get the sense that the Americans change quite a bit, that they throw at the wall and hope that some kind of partnership sticks and that there's not actually a process or a plan in place.
One of those little things that Luke did this time around was he slightly adjusted how his team qualified for this year's team based entirely on the idea he didn't particularly want rookies on this team, because statistically, you can break it down, rookies don't perform at away Ryder Cups. And so he decided to change the process in just a very subtle little way, and it made all the difference in the world. They had just one rookie, and the rest of the veterans performed like they did. Yes, I think you can directly go to the PGA of America on this. I kind of equated it to what happened when the PGA of America decided to go back in time and pick Tom Watson for a captaincy that he clearly wasn't qualified for. That's no indication. It's not criticism of Tom at all. His time had come and gone. He had no connection to the modern players, and it was pretty easy to see why the American team lost that Ryder Cup overseas. This feels very similar. This feels like an overreaction. This feels like it may be a knee-jerk reaction. PGA of America felt like they needed to do something to turn the tide, and clearly this wasn't it.
Brendan, how fascinating is Luke Donald's arc, where he wasn't even the captain originally picked in 2023? It was kind of a shotgun marriage for Team Europe after Henrik Stenson goes to LIV. And now you fast forward 3.5 years later, and the argument's being made that he's the best European Ryder captain of all time, European Ryder Cup captain of all time.
Well, I think it speaks to some of those institutional infrastructure elements we're talking about that may be lacking on the PGA of America side that are there in Europe and in the DP World Tour. Now, Luke Donald stepped into the role and had to perform, but they do have that background, that baseline. We walked out of Whistling Straits 4 years ago, you know, wondering who's next. What is this going to be, competitive home or away for the next 10 years? And of course, that was an overreaction in the moment and prisoner of the moment. But Luke Donald has stepped into a tour that really emphasizes 3 days every 2 years, puts so much into this, whereas PGA of America, this is a part and parcel of their trade association. The event was big and a success. It was certainly monetized this weekend. But you know, there's so much turnover at the top, whereas with the European Tour and the DP World Tour, there is this infrastructure going back to Seve Ballesteros, going back to Jose Maria Lotbol, who's still in the team room, almost 40 years of Ryder Cup experience, there is this baseline and continuity that Luke Donald could step into. And it is an incredible, incredible arc. Now, that's there. You then have to step up. And we haven't seen that maybe from Darren Clark or Patrick Harrington in preceding away Ryder Cups. But he was the perfect man for the perfect time. And it's quite a remarkable turnaround from Whistling Straits.
Rex, does the PGA of America have some questions that they need to come out and answer here? Because there was you have an MC that they hired who ends up leading vulgar chants about one of the opposing team. You have security that was slow to respond in terms of the fan behaviour, which the PGA of America had marketed itself towards for 12 years. Do they have some serious questions to answer about their actual handling of this event this time around?
And I think they probably need to address the idea that you two just sort of looked into, the idea that do we want to have another event at Bethpage? I had a chance to talk with Ted Bishop, who was the president of the PGA of America in 2013 when they announced they were taking the Ryder Cup to Bethpage. And I had him kind of walk me through the process. And to be quite honest, they knew what they were going to get with Bethpage. They knew what they were going to get with the New York fans. Maybe not to this extreme. Maybe they didn't anticipate Rory McIlroy being under fire the way he was all week long, but they certainly knew that the fans were going to elevate the experience. It is a tipping point. You can decide to move this to the New York area, and financially, it was certainly beneficial. From a brand marketing point of view, I think you can argue that this moved the Ryder Cup to a next level, that it put it more in line to what we see in mainstream sports. The byproduct of that is the ugly behavior that we saw, and by no means would I ever try to justify that. It was awful. No one should have to endure what the European team endured. But the PGA of America knew what they were getting, and I don't think anybody should be surprised now.
And they know what they're getting in the future. We're going to take a quick break, continue this conversation. When I come back, Brendan, I want you to answer whether or not the 2033 PGA Championship ought to be moved away from Bethpage because of what we saw over the weekend. We'll be right back. We just left it discussing the belligerence of the Bethpage fans, which didn't actually surprise anybody. Over the 12 years since they announced it was going there, everyone kind of expected this. It happens every event at Bethpage. It's happened at the PGA. It's happened at two US Opens. Should the PGA of America consider moving the 2033 PGA Championship away from that fan base?
I do think they should consider it. I don't think they will actually make the maneuver to move it away. I think we've seen this, like you said, this was not just some hyped up adversarial match play competition. I remember in 2019 when they issue reminders to ticket holders and post warnings, not just the warning of a sign on the golf course, warnings that, hey, if to paraphrase, if you're an idiot and you're shouting, we're going to throw you out. They had to post that in the middle of a regular tournament that doesn't have an adversarial bent to it, like the Ryder Cup. I think it should be considered. The sad thing is, Bethpage really is this American treasure. It should be held in high regard, this true municipal restoration project that the USGA initiated the turn of the century. It is one of the most important venues in America, but it seems incapable of hosting a big-time event with any sort of civility. And this is not a pearl-clutching moment. This is just something that's toxic and beyond the pale. Just not acceptable for any sport, let alone golf. It's way beyond the pale. I think they should consider if they can hold a massive fan-attended event there anymore.
Rex, how does the pendulum start to swing the other direction then with fan interaction in the Ryder Cup in 27 and beyond?
I think Rory sort of touched on it last night in his press conference, looking ahead to 2 years at Adair Manor in Ireland, trying to stress the idea that this is not acceptable behavior on either side of the Atlantic, that we don't want this to devolve into something where the matches only get hotter inside and outside the ropes. I think it's important to point out that what we saw on Saturday afternoon between Justin Rose and Tommy Fleetwood's caddy and Bryson DeChambeau's caddy, that's not acceptable either. It's gotten to the point where it's not about the competition anymore. It's about these petty flare-ups between players. It's about the fan behavior, which certainly I would agree with Brendan. It was over the top and unacceptable in any form of society. And so the idea that going overseas, trying to tone down the temperature in the room, I think that will probably be the focus for the next 2 years.
Do you think the subtext narrative all week long about the American players being paid to play in this Ryder Cup, Rex, had any kind of impact on the outcome It was a bit of a distraction, at least, and it was certainly a good propaganda point for the Europeans.
I think it's just one more item for Luke Donald to hang his hat on, and he did it brilliantly. He handled it in a very subtle, very nuanced way, but it was a tool in his box, and he was going to use it as a very sharp tool just to sort of poke at the Americans. It's all the little things. I'll put that right next to the shampoo and the comfy sheets in the rooms, and it's why he's such a good captain. He knew last December when the PGA of America announced that the stipend was going to be implemented, they were going to increase the amount that players got to go to charities. It was always going to be part of his plan to make a big deal about this, to make sure that the press makes a big deal about this and that the American players have to answer all of these questions, making it that much more uncomfortable. And the fans listen to what as well.
Brendan, playing off what you had said earlier on Golf Today, and I always say this half jokingly, we do these debriefs the Monday after the Ryder Cup, the winning captain's a genius, the losing captain's an idiot, and then you have to zoom out to look at, okay, what's happened over a four-year stretch, a 10-year stretch. If you go back 40 years, Europeans have won 14 of the last 20 Ryder Cups. They've won 9 of the last 12. Like, this isn't new by any means. It basically started in the mid-'80s. It persists today. If you could be put in charge, what do you think are the changes that the Americans have to make to level this out?
No one wants that. The PGA of America, the players, nobody wants me in charge of anything other than my own house, which I'm barely in charge of. The golf course setup was a critical error this time around. The shampoo, the bed sheets, that might be a marginal preparing to win. Failing to prepare is preparing to fail. All that cliche stuff you hear from coaches. The golf course setup was an actual critical miscalculation that Keegan Bradley, by his own admission on the record, said he made his mistake. Now, we may overemphasize golf course matters, you know, where I work at Fried Egg, but this week, the golf course, Bethpage Black, where they have this warning sign, this is the hard beast, was easier than the easiest PGA Tour courses. It was a putting contest, and we heard that from both sides, and you mitigated your own team's strengths. A Russell Henley, a Colin Morikawa, shorter hitters who are more accurate, were mitigated. Scottie Scheffler, accuracy, ball striking. By the numbers, they were dominant from tee to green, and then got blown out on the putting surfaces, which are pretty benign. And that was a critical error. By shaving the rough down, this beast of a course became among the easiest you would ever see on the PGA Tour, to the point where you had players saying it was better coming from the rough. It's a spin control. There was no penalty for missing anything. And I think that's a critical error where the PGA of America or the U.S. Ryder Cup side has to be more dialed in ahead of time. They knew this roster a month ago. They couldn't have predicted the rain, but it could have been better suited their team strengths.
Rex, one storyline came up during the afternoon yesterday. The envelope rule was invoked when Victor Hovland got injured. Harris English had a sit out and that match is halved. Keegan Bradley said afterwards that that rule needs to be changed. Now, he may actually have a point, but it sounds a little whiny whenever you signed a captain's agreement that has had that rule for 50 plus years and now you want to change it after the fact. Is there a case to be made that that rule is kind of outdated at this point, or should they add a 13th man who's sitting on the bench ready to step in?
I think I was most disappointing leaving that media center last night that Keegan didn't follow through and actually say what he thought might fix it, because I was really curious, how do you fix it? I mean, this is a kind of an archaic rule. It's an envelope. I don't know how many of the four of us on this roundtable actually have envelopes anymore, because no one actually sends mail. So I'm a little curious of how that works out. I will go to the idea, and I had a conversation with our colleague this morning, Brad Faxon, about it. You go to the Solheim Cup, if this similar situation comes up, a full point is awarded to the team that doesn't have the player that's injured. I'm not quite sure that's the answer. That would have felt a little unfair yesterday afternoon. Victor Hovland clearly would have loved to have been able to play that match. And if it would have actually impacted the outcome of the competition, I don't think anybody would have felt comfortable with that as well. You talk about getting an alternate, maybe put that in play, but I don't know how that would work as well with someone just sitting around all week long, maybe to play on Sunday afternoon, if that was the case. So I'm not quite sure if there's an elegant or simpler solution to this. I will go back on the idea that what Luke Donald kind of doubled down on, this is the rule. This is what we've all been playing on since the 70s. It's happened a couple of times. It's benefited the U.S. team. It's benefited the European team. I know a lot of people on social media are mad about it, but they're just mad about it because they didn't know about it before Sunday.
Brendan, you got a strong take on that from a competition standpoint?
It's the rule. It was a contract. It's like telling my kid, if you play video games now, you can't eat dessert later. And then he plays video games and wants his dessert. You signed up for the contract. I do think it's antiquated. You have a substitute or you forfeit the point. But this was the rule, and they were on the losing side, so they decided it needed to be changed. I'm sure if it came to their benefit, they would say, oh, perfect rule, no changes needed. But it did add a tinge of controversy to Sunday when it felt like it was going to be a whitewash.
Yeah, it seemed like it potentially was going to be in play if it was a 14-14 tie. I think in the spirit of competition, it would be nice to see some type of resolution in 2027. Thankfully, it didn't impact this Ryder Cup directly. Guys, great to spend time with you here on Golf Today, and love to get the breakdown of the Ryder Cup that was at Bethpage. Hour two of Golf Today, George Savarikas with Eamon Lynch, getting some different perspectives on what went right, what went wrong. For you, what is more glaring, the European success or the U.S. failure?
I think it's a pretty evenly matched scale. I think there was an assumption that we've seen built up over the last dozen years since this Ryder Cup was announced that the team, the fan dynamic would be decisive. And in some ways, I think it was, but there was an assumption that it was going to be decisive as a pro-American fan base. And because it was such an anti-European fan base, I think it actually fueled those guys. And you've seen, even from social media posts that some of the players have put out there in the last couple of days, how much bulletin board material matters to the European team. It gives them that little edge, the little chip on the shoulder. And the fans were actually delivering that same fuel to them mid-round in those matches. I think the fan base at Bethpage Black did more to contribute to the U.S. loss this week than Keegan Bradley's decisions.
Interesting. And you do see when Rory plays pissed off, a lot of times it's the best version of Rory McIlroy. Yeah. And he was the centerpiece for a lot of the abuse that the New York fans were giving the players. And we saw Rory cap what has been one of the most magical years of his career, winning at Pebble, the Masters, just completing the career Grand Slam, Irish Open, among the big victories that he's been able to put together, and now a Road Ryder Cup at the end of the year.
The American guys looked embarrassed by what was going on. You saw Justin Thomas out there having to take time out of a match to try to calm down some Yahoo who's got his beer goggles on. I mean, that's a distraction for the U.S. team. Scottie Scheffler looked embarrassed by what he was seeing out there as well.
Yeah, for sure. And left out the players as well for Rory McIlroy. But the clinching moment was from his good buddy, Shane Lowry. And this was after there had been so much of a U.S. run on Sunday in singles, making big putt after big putt on the 18th. But Lowry delivers the clinching moment. He will be forever etched in European Ryder Cup lore as the man who had the decisive half point to take care of business. But the crazy thing to me, and there were 11 matches played because we had the one half with Harris English and Victor Hovland because of Hovland's injury. Europe only won one match on Sunday. But thanks to their work the first 2 days, all they needed was one victory and a bunch of halves, and they're still able to win by two, with the final result being 15-13.
We tried to set the course up to help our team. Obviously, it wasn't the right decision. You know, I think anytime you're the leader of a team or you're the captain or the coach or whatever, we talked about this last night, you have to take, you're going to get the accolades and you need to take the blame for when things don't go well. And I definitely made a mistake on the course setup. I should have listened a little bit more to my intuition, and for whatever reason, that wasn't the right way to set the course up. We didn't expect the greens to be this soft. They were as soft as I've ever seen greens without it raining. And then, you know, especially here, it can get pretty firm, and they never firmed up.
You said your intuition. Did the data say to cut the rough?
No, I mean, I did and looked at a lot of info, and we thought this was the best way to set the golf course up to win. You look at past Ryder Cups, and that's kind of how it goes. But, sometimes, and you got to make a decision on what to do. And, if I could go back, I probably would have changed that. But, you know, the Europeans played just incredible golf. Doesn't matter how you set the course up when you play that well and you perform at that high level. I mean, that's as high of a level as a Ryder Cup team has ever played on for those 2 days, I think. And, when that happens, they just beat you sometimes.
Justin, you were active yesterday in whipping up the crowd before the game against Rory and Shane Lowry, and you witnessed the abuse that was dished out to them. And you also saw, I'm sure, that there were police dogs brought in and there were extra state troopers. How close do you think we're getting to a position where the safety of golfers, both US golfers and European golfers, is in danger?
I mean, I don't think anybody's safety was necessarily in danger. I understand what you're saying. I mean, words hurt too. There's definitely some nasty things said, but I don't think anybody was necessarily fearing for their life or was in any kind of situation where they were going to get hurt. But yeah, I think it's anybody that was out there could pretty blatantly tell you that there was some things said. And yeah, it was, I mean, I said it to Cam and I said it to Shane and Rory yesterday that we felt for him. It was, you know, it was unfortunate. And Cam and I just wish that we gave them something to cheer for instead of people to cheer against. I think that was kind of the main consensus of the last 2 days, and we weren't giving them enough to cheer for. And they were just trying to help us win. But I guess that's the New York fans for you.
I don't think we should ever accept that in golf. I think golf should be held to a higher standard than what was, you know, than what was seen out there this week. Golf has the ability to unite people. Golf teaches you very good life lessons. It teaches you etiquette. It teaches you how to play by the rules. It teaches you how to respect people. And, you know, sometimes this week we didn't see that. So, this should not be what is acceptable in the Ryder Cup. But, you know, we will be making sure to say to our fans in Ireland in 2027 that, you know, what happened here this week is not acceptable. And it's, you know, for me, it's, you know, come and support your home team. You know, come and support your team. You know, I think if I was an American, I would be annoyed that people, I didn't hear a lot of shouts for Scotty today, but I heard a lot of shouts against me. And it's like, support your players. You know, that's the thing. So, look, it was a rough week for all of us. But at the same time, you know, we shut them up by our performance and how we played. And we tried to, you know, I chirped back a few times because it got to me a few times. But we tried to handle everything that came our way with class and poise. And for the most part, I felt like we did that.
With all that in mind, everything you go through, how satisfying is it to turn around to someone and say, quote, shut the F up and then stiff it to 2 feet?
Very satisfying.
Congratulations.
The Ryder Cup weeks are the best weeks of our lives. We talk about this all the time. You know, those individual accolades are fun. We want to achieve as much as we can. Rory has achieved so much in the game. You know, his place in history is set. But I think those weeks we spend together are the ones we remember the most and we cherish the most because of the times we get to spend with each other. Now that's a big part of my captaincy, is to create an environment where these guys having the best weeks of their lives, honestly. You know, we'll always remember this. We'll always go down in history. We talk about all the people that came before us, that paved the way for us. Now future generations will talk about this team tonight and what they did and how they were able to overcome one of the toughest environments in all of sport. And that is inspiring to me. And that's what Rory gets and all these other 11 guys get as well.
Continuing the conversation now with Golf Digest contributor Shane Ryan, who joins the show. Shane, I know it's a long Ryder Cup week at Bethpage. What would be your headline for the 45th playing of this event?
Yeah, you know, I liked what Eamon said earlier, where there's really this 50-50 split between being so impressed by what Luke Donald and the Europeans did, not just in how they played, but in how they prepared for this incredible challenge of winning a Road Ryder Cup, which nobody has done in a decade, versus on the other side, the, you know, sort of dumbfounding American decisions that were made that really put them behind the eight ball in the pairs matches until we could get past the sort of, you know, captaincy parts of it into the singles. and their talent and their, you know, their spirit could shine through. And they did a really great job on Sunday. But as you said, George, just, you know, way too far behind. Even, you know, this is the kind of margin that they got where if they were down 10-6, they would have had another Brookline, another Medina. They would have come back and won. But they were way too far down to have it matter, unfortunately.
Was too much of the narrative into this Ryder Cup and even during the week about the captain, Shane? Because, you know, he had that Netflix moment. It spurs this shock pick for the captaincy. Then you even had the moment in his speech. It was kind of all about Keegan. And this a narrative for the last year, will Keegan play on his own team? And then you flip that and you listen to Luke Donald talk about the past generations of players. He's always focused on players. The Bradley captaincy seemed very much focused on Bradley.
Well, yeah, Eamon, as a student of history, you'll know this concept of the great man theory, where, you know, the belief that, no, it's this one guy that influences things, that can do great things and change the course of history, versus the system theory of history, that we are, you know, subject to these broader principles that are happening, and what's more important is to build a network of things that can go on. Well, Luke Donald was doing the system theory, right? I mean, he is, first of all, standing on the shoulders of the European giants who have developed a strong Ryder Cup system for about 40 years now, and improving it and doing such a wonderful job. And then Keegan comes in as this rogue pick, and it's, yeah, like you said, it's all about him and that Netflix clip from the President's Cup. He's making this big proclamation that they're going to go, you know, beat the Europeans badly, to paraphrase for a polite TV audience. And there's a lot of me in the thing. And I think Keegan was respected by his players, but he is operating under this principle that by willpower alone, he is going to do it. Well, the last time the U.S. did that, we had this rogue captain's pick that kind of came out of left field was Tom Watson in 2014. And we all saw what happened in Glen Eagles. And then we saw it play out here again. What the U.S. needs to do is go back to what they did successfully after Tom Watson with the task force, which I know is a punchline, but actually did a lot of great things building up. And they had success under Davis Love, who is that Luke Donald kind of captain, Stricker. And then they had a bad time in Rome and they abandoned it. They need to get back to that. And they need to do it quickly.
But, I mean, they got blown out in 2018 also. So they basically won two home Ryder Cups, got smoked on the road twice, and then abandoned the task force. So I would say the results were a bit muddled at best for the U.S. team.
Well, you know, look, you can look at each individual Ryder Cup as its own story. Something like Paris, it felt like they had a lot of bad luck with Furyk's captain's picks. When you get to Rome, everybody's sick that week. So things can happen. And I realize you can say, well, you're retrofitting a narrative to support your argument. But those home Ryder Cups that they were winning, George, that was not what happened in 2004, right? I mean, they got embarrassed there. And now that they've abandoned it again, they're not winning home Ryder Cups, okay? So if best case scenario is 50-50, well, that's pretty good, right? Considering the history of the U.S. for the last 30 years. And look what happens when you abandon it. 50-50 is out the window. And I don't know if you can find anybody today, no matter how much they love America and the American team, who could make a convincing argument that these guys have any chance in a dare manner in 2 years.
Well, and so I think we would all agree that the structure for the U.S. team is fundamentally broken if they've lost 9 of the last 12. If you looked at any sport and if someone had lost 9 of 12, then it's a horrific losing streak and you're trying to pull any lever to figure out, is it the players? Is it the captain? Is it the organization in total? So how do you assign culpability if you look at not just what happened this week, but recent history as well?
Well, again, you know, I was front and center for the Hazeltine and the Whistling Straits Ryder Cups. And to your point, yeah, you know, Paris was bad. Rome was really bad. But those were very, very good Ryder Cups. And those guys were really organized. It wasn't just that the U.S. played well. It's that they had really good plans coming into place. I remember talking to Davis Love after Whistling Straits and Steve Stricker, too. And, you know, Love was an assistant. And he was saying, you know, all the small logistical things we did. And we're looking into, you know, how to do it even better next time, like how to make the transport better, how to make the food better. And those are small things, but they hint when you're planning out those little details, they hint at the bigger things. And so, again, look at Whistling Straits. Padraig Harrington didn't know until a couple days before that two of his alt shot players were playing a different ball. This is something that the U.S. had covered months earlier. Davis Love said, we got the list from the tour. We made sure this wasn't a problem. Right. And so all these little things add up. And at the end of the day, you see this huge margin. You go, well, there's nothing they could have done. Well, actually, Keegan Bradley could have not put his statistically worse pairing out of 132 options out in foursomes. And then when it proved to be a disaster, he didn't have to do it again. And you go, well, that's just 2 points. Well, it was a 2-point margin, wasn't it? And that just hints at, you know, decisions that maybe we don't know yet that we might learn or we may never know that might have gone the same way. Where on the flip side, you have Luke Donald checking every box, planning meticulously, and setting his guys up to, you know, to have the most success that they can.
Shane, the subtext all week was the money that the U.S. team players were getting for the first time. $500,000 per man, 300 of it going to charity, the other 200 to do with as they wish. Most of them said it was going to charity. That's, if you take the 200 grand from each man, that's 2.4 million. Is that enough to hire Luke Donald to be the American captain at Adair Manor in 2 years?
Yeah, I said, look, name your price tag Eduardo Molinari, right? Anybody. Well, this is what we need. We need Europeans. Like the same way that, you know, when they brought soccer to America, you bring the coaches over from England. Clearly, they know what's going on over there better than us. We need somebody. Maybe Bernard Langer will come out of retirement. Anything different.
What's the right balance with this type of event for fan behavior?
Well, the problem is, I think these things are somewhat inevitable, and it's sad, and I'm not defending it, but when you look at the math of what happened, let's say I followed Rory on Friday, and that wasn't as bad as Saturday, but let's say every hole that Rory played on Saturday, he's got 4 to 5 people making heinous comments to him, right? Well, over 18 holes, I'm not the best at math, but that's like 60, 70 people. That's a pretty small percentage of a crowd of 50,000. And that's not to defend what they said. It was awful. And Rory was right that there should be a higher standard. But it's a little bit funny and ironic to have these British journalists going, is this dire, blah, blah, blah. And at their soccer matches, they have people getting stabbed, right? So I'm just saying, let's keep it in context. I think there are things that they could have done. I had a colleague who said, why isn't there a marshal or a cop or somebody going ahead of these guys to the green saying, listen, cheering for your team is fully heckling. Even some kind of heckling is okay. Don't make personal comments and don't talk while they're swinging. And anybody who does is going to get kicked out and arrested. Or, you know, maybe arrested is strong there. but something like that. You know, why not do something like that? You can prevent it. But I also don't want to get carried away in saying this was bedlam. Nobody got hurt. Nobody was in danger of getting hurt. So I think there are two sides to that story there.
Well, Eamon wanted a cattle prod earlier. So an arrest might be easier for some than what you were recommending.
Well, I've probably spent more time around Long Island sports fans than Shane has at this point. Shane, we've got a lot to kick over in the next couple of years before we get to do it all again. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Shane.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
And a tweet from another two-time captain on the American side earlier today, Tom Watson. I'd like to congratulate Ryder Cup Europe on their victory. Your team play the first few days was sensational. More importantly, I'd like to apologise for the rude and mean-spirited behaviour from our American crowd at Bethpage. As a former player, captain and as an American, I'm ashamed of what happened. We're joined now by Brandel Chambly. Brandel, we just saw what Tom Watson had to say there. Is that where we are at this event now, where there's this kind of overwhelming sense of crowd nastiness that seems to take over?
Well, I certainly agree with Tom Watson there. We had talked about it almost from the minute the final putt was hit in Rome, about how potentially New York was going to be embarrassing. And for all the time we talked about it, I don't think we could imagine it being this embarrassing. You know, if you look at a place that will not tolerate boorish behavior, they message properly at the outset. And I'm talking about Augusta National, the Masters. People know when they walk onto the grounds there that they're expected to react and act responsibly and respectfully and within the traditions of the game. And I think Rory really did hit the right tone last night in the media center, saying golf needs to hold itself to a different standard. And I do think, and look, I want to paint with a broad brush here, but there needed to be more strenuous messaging from the PGA of America, from Keegan, from everybody involved, saying, come, enjoy the Ryder Cup, cheer your team on, cheer your players on. But if you interrupt the play, if you're yelling in backswings, or if you hurl insults, or if you are profane, you will be ejected immediately from the grounds. And I think, to some extent, messaging could have ameliorated these insults to some extent. But it was a sad blemish on the great competition that these teams put out.
Randall, is this more an anomaly or kind of the current state of affairs when it comes to the U.S. hosting a Ryder Cup and that type of fan behavior? I know 21 in Whistling Straits was more of a COVID Ryder Cup. 16, I don't remember the crowds being as big a part of the narrative at Hazeltine or even 2012 at Medina. What would your take be?
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of reasons, and somebody could probably get a PhD on the fact that we've just become less civil in the world. Maybe it's social media that gins up, algorithmically moves up the loudest, most obnoxious, most objectionable comments, and it sort of motivates people to that end. Am I going to get a meme? Am I going to get some time on social media posts? Is somebody going to show a video of me? I don't know. I mean, we used to just applaud the heights of comportment, and now we laud the most obnoxious. It is sad, but I think Rory's message and going forward, 4 years hence when the Ryder Cup comes back here, I think the messaging needs to take a more strenuous tone to end that. You should be able to come out there, to Rory's point, and cheer on your team, but don't interrupt the play and stop with the profane insults being hurled. How about the comedian that was hired to entertain people on the first tee, thinking that it was a great idea to start the crowd in a chant of F you Rory, F you Rory? Who thinks of that? Who thinks that's a good idea? What if you brought your kids out there, your mom and your dad who, don't talk like that. And you're like, you're just trying to enjoy a sporting event, and the whole crowd's engaged in a profane, insulting chant to Rory, who all he does is just play his heart out. He was in the media center before the Ryder Cup started talking about that America was the greatest country in the world. They come here, they pay taxes here, they run charities here, they give prolifically, philanthropically. I thought it was absolutely embarrassing.
Let's talk about the actual golf for a change. Brandel, do you buy this argument that we hear whenever the United States loses, it's simply, these guys just played better? Or do you see institutional issues on the U.S. side that just don't seem to be addressed?
That's a good question, Eamon. I heard people say, Europe won because they made more putts. That's like saying a football team won because they scored more points. The devil is in the details. There's a reason why Europe putted better than the U.S. The United States was quite a bit better putters coming into this event statistically than Europe. But yeah, I think it is institutional messaging to the team. It goes all the way back to it. And again, I think on the whole, Keegan did a nice job, but there are just things that he could have done to message his team and give them a greater sense of purpose and the proper, I think, respect and humility. Going back and to the Netflix when he said, "We're going to go to Bethpage, we're going to kick their effing ass." Okay, so I just couldn't imagine a Paul McGinley or a Luke Donald saying something like that. And if you just think that, and he dismissed it as, I was in the heat of the moment, blah, blah, blah. And that's all fair. But if you don't think that's bulletin board material, if you woke up this morning, you went on to X, and you saw that they had put that quote on the board in the locker room for European Tour players, and just too often the messaging isn't right. It's not humble enough. It's not respectful enough. And it ignites a fire in the U.S. team, or excuse me, in the European team. And the European team just psychologically plays the underdog game very well as Lee Trevino used to play it against Jack Nicklaus. They come in humble, they come in respectful, they say, "We've got a formidable task and we're playing a great team," and they just set the right message and tone.
Randall, when you look at the U.S. side, and let's go through a team sports lens, you're very familiar with the Dallas Cowboys. It's easy for a coach to shoulder a lot of the blame, like Mike McCarthy just did when he was recently fired by the Cowboys. But then when you have systemic failure with an organization, Cowboys haven't won a Super Bowl in 30 years, you zoom out, Jerry Jones and the ownership gets a lot of blame. So how do you balance it being the captain in a two-year cycle versus the PGA of America now overseeing what has been a U.S. side that has lost 9 of the last 12 Ryder Cups?
Yeah, I think they tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater, sort of overreact. I think they could just simply take a page out of Europe's book. you know, you first of all, you do need great stats teams. You really do. You know, Luke was certainly important to the messaging of this team, but in terms of putting the teams out there, Eduardo Molinari is relatively unheralded as the leader of this team. And when you see the mistakes time and time again that the U.S. makes in their foursomes pairing, I'll go back to France when Bryson DeChambeau and Phil Mickelson were put out in a foursomes team on a very tight golf course with very thick rough. I thought that was the worst pairing I'd ever seen in foursomes on either side until Colin Morikawa and Harris English went out. And look, this isn't disrespectful to them. They're great players. Otherwise, they wouldn't be on the Ryder Cup team. But relative to the other players in the team, relative to the nature of this golf course, they were the worst of the worst teams from a foursome standpoint. And they rolled them out not once, but twice. So they both lost. So if they win one of those matches, it's a 14-14 tie. If they win both, it's a 15-13 flip win for the U.S. When Russell Henley hit first off the tee playing with Scottie Scheffler in the foursomes, I've heard that the stats team from Europe turned around and said to the room, that is 1 point for us. He hit one shot, and they knew on their data that was a point for them. All the data said that Scottie Scheffler should have been hitting first there or played with somebody who hit it farther, and then Scottie Scheffler should have hit off of two. So these are not small mistakes. These are big strategic mistakes. So he needs to hire great people, whoever the next captain is, and it should be Justin Leonard. Hire great people, put great people around them, get great data, and then come in and talk about how they are the underdog, because the U.S. is the underdog. I don't care what the world rankings say. I don't care what the Data Golf world rankings say. The next Ryder Cup, the United States will be a decided underdog going to Ireland. And they need to play that card beautifully the way Europe does.
The specter of money hung over this Ryder Cup as well, Brandel. This being the first time that the U.S. players were paid directly, even though they said all of the money in most cases was going to charity. Do you think they owe a refund?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. That's funny. You know, regardless of what people want to say, whether or not they have the right to be paid or not, I think it proved to be a distraction. They were asked about it numerous times. I can only imagine, you know, if any of them were on social media, the vitriol they would have been getting from the world saying, why this team, and by far the richest era in the history of golf, why is this team demanding money for the privilege and the honor of playing for your country? And I thought Luke Donald's comments in his opening remarks were both strategic in terms of letting the audience know who they were cheering for. In other words, people who needed to be paid to play for the honor of their country, but also emboldening to his own team in the sense that they were united around a common bond of we are playing for pride. We are playing for things that money cannot buy. And again, I think it was a huge distraction. And look, it caused some anger on the U.S. side. They were mad at Luke's Donald comments about it. And they were mad that they were being asked about it. You could see their body language change in the media center. And you feel what you focus on. And so their focus was on the slights that were being thrown at them. So they weren't playing, I think, that they weren't in the best frame of mind to play their best golf. They were playing without the clear focus of purpose that that Europe was playing with, I think, subsequently.
Randall, so much of the conversation had been leading up to the Ryder Cup, should Keegan Bradley play? And if you look just objectively at where he was at the end of the Tour Championship, if he wasn't Keegan Bradley the captain, he was among arguably the nine best American side. So did the PGA of America put the U.S. team at a competitive disadvantage when it comes to just having the 12 best players in the lineup? And would Keegan, the player, have made an impact on this Ryder Cup if someone else had been captain?
Well, there's a sense that if he had picked himself, he wasn't going to pick Cameron Young. And Cameron Young was the best thing about the U.S. team. So, you know, it wasn't like Keegan Bradley's form was demonstrably better. Yeah, on the whole, on the year, you could look at where his play was. But if you looked more closely at his last four or five events, going into the Ryder Cup, he wouldn't have been in the top 12. not on current form. Or if he would have been, it would have been by the narrowest of margins. It wasn't like he was demonstrably playing great golf. By his standards, he was playing okay. And, you know, I think it's important for a captain to go in and focus on the things that he should have been focusing on, which was messaging his team and giving them the right frame of mind to go out and play their best golf. But having said that, you know, it was just, it was, and I like Keegan. He comes up on our set. He's generous. He's a hell of a player. But, you know, if you go back and look at the last 10 U.S. captains, on average, they'd played in about 5 Ryder Cups. And so, you know, they were more familiar, I would argue, with the history and the knowledge of the Ryder Cup. Now, having said that, they haven't been particularly successful. So maybe they were just trying to mix things up. It was a little bit of a gamble on their part. But it's not the answer. They've got to hire somebody more, I think, in the lines of a Luke Donald, who's methodical, who's thoughtful, who puts a great team behind them, and then listens to them. But it does, I think, really start with the data. You got to have a better data team.
The devil is in the details, as they say. Brandel, good to be with you for this Ryder Cup postmortem on golf today.
Nice to join you guys. Y'all take care. Have a good day.
For more, we now welcome in Joel Beal, senior writer for Golf Digest. Joel, I know it's a eventful Ryder Cup week, to say the least. What would be your biggest takeaway from what you saw at Bethpage?
I think the fan engagement and where we go from here, because what I saw, especially on Saturday afternoon following Rory McIlroy, I mean, it embarrassed me as a golfer, as an American, just as a human, frankly. You know, I know people accuse media of hyperbole all the time, but that Saturday afternoon especially, it was the worst type of behavior I've ever seen at a sporting event, at least. I know instinctually people are going to point the blame at New York fans, especially given Bethpage has had a history of incidents like this. But I don't think that really gets to the heart of the matter. In fact, I walked most of that afternoon with my friend Brendan Quinn from The Athletic. He made a good point that you could tell they're not New York fans, because if they were, they would have been booing the U.S. team for their performance up to that point. Instead, I think it's behavior that underlines, frankly, what we've seen in our country for some time, that people feel entitled, that they're allowed to, supposed to even abuse people who don't believe the same things they do. Obviously, that's a very deep-seated issue outside of our realm of golf. But I do think there's a chance to curb this going forward. And I think a lot of that lies with the PGA of America. Talking to both teams on Saturday and a little bit last night as well, they were just taken aback how the PGA had no apparent interest in policing the situation until it kind of reached this point of no return. Especially the Americans, you know, I know the Europeans are hurt, but a lot of the Americans felt like it was beholden on them to really control the crowd, which, given everything that's at stake here, that's a distraction they don't need. I think if the PGA has a zero tolerance policy to this behavior going forward and actually gives a damn about enforcing it, I do think it will go ways in stopping the issue. And they have to, because this is as big of a threat to the long-term health of the Ryder Cup as the competitive integrity or lack thereof over the past 2 decades.
Yeah, Joel, this is one of these questions the PGA of America really needs to come out to answer, because it's not just that they're putting European players in the position of being abused. They're actually putting the U.S. team in the position of having to get involved. We saw that with Justin Thomas during the course of Saturday's play and how distracted and embarrassed these guys become. Do you think that they over-marketed this event, saying this is going to be loud, it's going to be crazy, and then emboldened the fans to do this, and now they're just kind of trying to hide instead of put up their hands and say, well, this isn't our fault, we didn't know it was going to get this bad, when that's clearly what everyone expected to happen?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the European team had to train with VR headsets preparing for the vitriol they knew was coming, and at the same time, there's no way for preparing for what they faced. I think there is a little bit of that. I do think, well, it was, you know, especially Saturday following Rory, he was actually more disgusted just kind of at the lack of policing, not only with the referees and volunteers, but I mean, the police really didn't get there to the sixth hole and really in number until the 10th. And that was just way too long for the things being shouted at him, being yelled at him. And I think that's the point where you talk to folks going into the tournament. They mentioned, we were not going to let things go over the line, especially if things are pointed to a player's family. We're going to pull them out. We'll kick them out. And again, following that group, I can tell you that just didn't happen, despite multiple people on the European team pointing certain perpetrators out, and the volunteers and marshals and even a few security folks just kind of shrugged their shoulders. So I understand where you're going with that, with embolden.
In fact, though, I think that honestly, one of the main narratives of the first three sessions was the lack of crowd involvement. Granted, they didn't have much to cheer with, but they almost didn't know the crowd was almost on the other side of the spectrum of they didn't know what to do. They felt like they were there just more for a party than a golf event. And I think more of Saturday afternoon was just an offshoot of some xenophobia, some people getting out of control. I think liquor had a role in it. But yeah, it was one of the worst things I've seen, at least on the golf front, in my 10 years covering the sport.
The crowd, clearly one of the big takeaways as far as the spectacle and how the pendulum needs to swing in the future, especially with Ryder Cups in the U.S. When we drill into the two teams, and Eamon had posed this question earlier, and it's something that we've been discussing throughout the show, is the story more about what Europe has been able to do with the sustained run of dominance and Luke Donald now winning two straights as captain, or more of the U.S. failures that were magnified this week with some of maybe the decisions by Keegan Bradley?
Most speaking out of both sides of my mouth, because I think we have a bad habit of not giving the winner enough credit. So many times it's always who blew it. And yeah, what we saw those first 2 days, it's clear that there's just no official permanent apparatus to the U.S. like the Europe has. You know, Europe has this entire structure designed specifically for this event, held just 3 days every 2 years. And yet you see the little touches like that come into play, like such as, you know, coming 2 weeks early to avoid jet lag, having meaningful and sentimental touches in the uniforms, even the storytelling we see from the official team European sites, they're all rowing in the same direction. And it's not why European wins most of the time. It's just why they continually outperform, because their team is giving the players the best chance to succeed. The fact that the Europeans lost an entire generation of captains to live and were able to just plug Luke Donald in kind of, I think, speaks to that. It's the system. It's not necessarily the people. And the U.S. just doesn't have that. America essentially just rolls out its 12 best players and hopes that will do. And because nothing is cohesive, you get so many self-inflicted mistakes. And that goes from the big, from the English Morikawa pairing to the course setup, to even the smaller things like the first DMC stepping down in disgrace, which still is incredible. We're had to say that sentence. So I think the only hope for the Americans is to implement something similar to what Team USA basketball did about 20 years ago after some poor performances in FIBA and the Olympics, where there's a structure of people dedicated solely to this pursuit. It may seem like overkill, and in some ways it can be, but there's enough money in this event to fund it. And I think that's the only way to consistently match what European does every time this event is played.
Joel, you mentioned the Americans throwing out the 12 best players without the apparatus around them. It's a similar point that Luke Donald made, quoting Michael Jordan, during the week at Bethpage, when he said you can have a team of champions that is not necessarily a championship team. Do you read anything into the fact that the rally the United States team put on yesterday came when all these guys played as 12 individuals, rather than when they actually played with a partner and having that kind of strategic mentality required of them in the first 2 days when they didn't deliver?
Certainly, you have to give them credit for at least showing up and doing their best. But honestly, that just underlines the expanse that the Europeans are a team. And it's a cultural thing. If you ask European players growing up what their goals are, it's the Open and making a Ryder Cup team in some order. If you ask American golfers growing up, I don't know if the Ryder Cup's in the top 10. I think it's the Masters, U.S. Open, probably their own, watching their college football team win a national championship. And having things like that ingrained at such an early age, there's just this inherent pull for each other that the Americans just don't have at this moment.
Well, I'm sure they're going to face many of questions about it over the next 2 years before we get to Ireland. Joel, it's always good to catch up with you.
Appreciate it, Joel.
Thanks, guys.